Wow. You know, the Section 101 mess would be fixed. It would undo the complete mess that the jurisprudence is today. And it would be a huge win for those who believe that we should have some predictability, a stable patent system where inventors, innovators, and investors know that what is patent eligible and not patent eligible under U.S. law. I think if you believe that, if you believe that patents are good, if you believe that stability and predictability are good, I think you should support this Patent Injury Restoration Act.
Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by Harrity, the go-to firm for the Patent 300 for patent preparation and prosecution. After you're done listening to this episode, don't forget to share it with others and please leave a 5-star rating wherever you're listening now. And now here's your host, Eli Mazur.
All right, welcome to the Clause 8 podcast, the new season of the Clause 8 podcast. We took some time off for conference season and the back of the new school year, but we're back now and we're excited to share new episodes with you this season. I'm going to actually do something different this episode. I don't have any guests planned, but I wanted to discuss some of these topics that were discussed at these conferences and panels that I got to moderate and some related issues that have come up as well. It's going to be a little different. You'll hear more of my perspective, I hope, and hopefully you like that. But let me know what you think. I'm always open for feedback and figure it out as we go along. It doesn't feel right to me to start this season of the Clause 8 podcast at this time without mentioning the horrific terrorist attacks that happened in Israel on October 7th. I think another podcast host put it correctly. He called it the great forgetting about what happened less than a month ago on the day that I'm recording this today. So I'm sure everybody's heard of the news, the horrific news, but just the way that people go about their days and start thinking about different things, they forget about that. So I think it's useful to remind for everybody to remember what happened. Hamas terrorists came into Israel on October 7th and killed more Jews on that day than 80 days since the Holocaust. There's still over 200 Israelis captured, being tortured, being held against their will by the Hamas terrorists. Countless babies, children, elderly, disabled women were tortured in unspeakable ways and horrific ways. I obviously won't mention them on this podcast, but it is worth to know about that such evil does exist in this world. And for those of us who've lived in America through September 11th, the scale of that attack compared to the small size of the country that Israel is just absolutely horrific. My prayers, thinking about Israel, my prayers are with Israel and the Israeli Defense Force so they defeat those terrorists and try to return to life as normal as possible. If you listen to the previous episodes, you've probably heard my interview with Lillian Shaked, and she obviously lives in Israel, my previous guest. But actually, some of you might not know that my first interview in the IP world was actually with, the director of the Israeli Patent Office. So through a friend of mine, Bill Mandier, partner at a big IP firm, he invited me to come on this APLA trip with him and I believe the executive director and the president of APLA at the time. And it was a group of patent attorneys who came on this trip, and we got to meet a lot of different Israeli patent attorneys and officials there. And one of the people that I met was Asa Kling, and I thought he had a very interesting story to tell about the Israeli patent system. And he did tell me that. So I ended up interviewing him for IP Watchdog, but it was in written form, not through oral form. And I got to, that was the first interview that I did with somebody in the IP world. So it's still available online if you're interested to check that out. All right. Well, now I guess to last important matters. You know, what's been going on in the patent and IP world since the last episode of the Clause 8. Obviously, you know, one of the hottest topics continues to be artificial intelligence. And that also happens to be, unsurprisingly, the topic of conversations at many of these conferences, IP conferences that happened over the last few months. I remember when I interviewed Ryan Abbott, he's obviously famous for bringing light the question about whether artificial intelligence can be an inventor under U.S. patent law and under other jurisdictions around the world. And it was part of the Dabbous Project, and he filed a lot of cases around the world, testing that in legal forms and courts, the question of whether AI can be named as an inventor. It was, I think it brought that question to the forefront, but at the time, I remember a lot of people were skeptical. Even patent attorneys who worked with AI, who helped other inventors obtain patents related to artificial intelligence, thought that Professor Ryan Abbott was stirring up trouble by bringing this question to light. They said, well, of course, AI cannot be an inventor. What a ridiculous question. What a waste of time to even pose that. And as soon as ChatGPT came out, I think the conversation immediately changed. And it was interesting to watch that because the same people that I saw that were previously skeptical were kind of like, this is the future. When will AI take over our jobs and so forth? So I think it was interesting to see how quickly that evolution happened, the imagination that people had in terms of what AI can do. I'll leave the debate about whether AI can be named, quote unquote, an inventor to others. One thing that I saw, and obviously I interviewed Sean Lillimo on the last season, the head of software development in my firm, and we talked a lot about artificial intelligence. I think I might have mentioned it there, but it kind of stuck out to me as I've been going through these conferences and talking to patent attorneys from all over. One is obviously, you know, there's people who are super excited about this technology, including companies, software tools, companies that provide software tools for patent attorneys. You know, the day after ChatGPT, and I'm exaggerating a bit, but the day after ChatGPT came out, they said, they just like AI powered in front of whatever they were doing as a way to market their tools because they knew people were excited. And obviously, you know, the people selling those tools are a little more at the front than others. Another thing that kind of struck out to me is, you know, a lot of people are very excited and interested to know where this AI tool goes, but I don't think people are really even caught up to the innovation that's already happened in our field in terms of our patent practice for patent attorneys, you know, the tools that are available for patent prosecution and patent preparation and so forth, automation tools, you know, tools that don't involve any AI, but tools that help you do the menial tasks quicker, more efficiently, more accurately, and so forth. Our firm has our own tools that do that, but there's other companies, Patent Bots and Patent Pals and so forth, that have their own tools. So I would I'm on these conferences, and some people actually recognize me from the conversations I had with Sean Lillimo. Anyways, they'd come up to me, and they're very excitedly talking about the future of AI. And I would ask them, well, are you using any of these tools, any of these non-AI software tools? And the question, I was surprised how commonly was, no, thought about it, trying it, we tried it one time, we just don't know if it's going to work for us, and so forth. And I think that speaks to the difficulty, obviously, of getting attorneys and patent attorneys to adopt new tools. But it also speaks to, you know, the forces that shape what attorneys do. And attorneys are very busy. So if there's going to be some tool that they don't see an immediate return on in terms of efficiency and so forth, of using it, proofreading and so forth, they might not choose not to use it again. So I think even before we get to AI, there's a lot that attorneys can do in their own practice in terms of checking out these tools and adopting them. The second thing that really stuck out to me is, and I did I moderated a panel about this topic at the USPTO, and I'll get that to a minute, but about a panel about practitioners using it. But another thing that kind of stuck out to me is that lawyers, as lawyers tend to do, when you start talking to them about something new and unused, they rightly start thinking about the risks, the ethical concerns, and so forth about what it would mean to use new kinds of tools. And it kind of takes me to a story about when I started practicing. We had a client who, whenever we did an invention disclosure call with their inventors who were even halfway around the world, they would want us to go to their local office, their local sales office, and use the secure communications lines that they had there to take this disclosure call for this patent mention. And that's how they did it. And, you know, we did that. You know, we would go to these rooms, we would set it up, and, you know, we would record it. We would bring some kind of recorder to kind of record these calls that are happening in the secure. And then obviously one day they realized, you know, you could have the same, an equally or secure enough conversation through people, you know, using one of these publicly available video channels. That made me think about it because obviously, you know, that is a valid concern that attorneys had, right? after they stopped meeting with inventors in person, whether, you know, it's secure or confidential type of call and so forth. So I think these are the same kind of concerns that you're hearing about AI, and very valid concerns about confidentiality, about some of these legal issues, right? About if you're going to, if the LLM model that you're using for your patent application spits out some new idea, going back to our conversation about AI inventors, is that an issue? So there's a lot of issues to think through. And I think it is wise to kind of err on the side of caution and err on the side of not using these tools before or thinking through all of these issues. So I'm a firm believer on that. But I don't think that should stop practitioners from thinking about these issues and kind of figuring out a way to get there where they can use these AI tools the same way we use other tools. The USPTO, as I mentioned, they were having this, they have these AI events, and one of them they devoted to the topic of practitioners using AI. Before I get to that, I guess I want to kind of highlight the USPTO's own leadership on the topic. I'm not sure, this was around the same time I think I interviewed Ryan Abbott, but USPTO announced, I think under former director Iancu, that they're going to create this new position called Director of Emerging Technologies. And they found a very impressive candidate from outside the patent field, Jerry Ma, to be in that position. So he was their first director of emerging technologies. He was very impressive, obviously very passionate about those issues. But, you know, to be honest, I was very skeptical. I was like, all right, he's going to become coming into this humongous organization. If anybody watches this, any of the other IT stuff that happens with government or USPTO, it's extremely hard to get anything done. Nice to have somebody with a title, Director of Emerging Technologies, to kind of say they're looking into these AI issues, but nothing is going to come of it. And you know, I was completely wrong for that skepticism. And it might be just a unique person that they found, Jerry Ma, like I mentioned, who turned out to be one of the most impressive public servants that I've come across within and outside of the USPTO, who's really devoted himself. And part of it is that the USPTO has really been at the forefront of the conversation about AI within government, within the USPTO, but also within the patent system and of the whole ecosystem that comes with that. So when the ChatGPT thing came out, I think they were kind of ready for it much more than most, because they've been deeply thinking about these topics, thanks to Jerry Ma and his whole impressive team over there that focuses on those issues. They've kind of not only talked about these issues in terms of having all of these sessions and, you know, putting out requests for comments and so forth, they've actually developed and started implementing tools at the use and started using tools that involve artificial intelligence. So my understanding is that there's been tools, I guess, for searching and classification that involve some kind of artificial intelligence for a while. But at this event that they held, they demonstrated actually these tools that involved for searching, for helping examiners find the best prior art. And wow, it actually works. And when the examiner finds prior art using those tools, they will disclose that within the office section. I think there was some crazy statistics about, I forget, I don't want to say wrong thing, but you're a million searches or a million results or something like that that have been provided this tool. So they're really at the forefront of not really just thinking about these issues, but actually putting AI into practice. I don't think there's anybody else in our field who can kind of say that. So it's very, very impressive by the USPTO. So I moderated an event there, going back to that. And there was, I think, from the practitioner side, I think mostly the kind of hesitancy and concerns that I've heard at other conference events as well. You always want to have informed consent from a client. Obviously, get your client in part of the conversation. But I think in terms of thinking about where this could go in the future, I don't think the patent practitioner community has really wrapped their heads around completely. You know, one thing, you know, one of the panelists, and she brought up a very good point about how we've seen this kind of evolution on the patent litigation side because of document review, right? And document review, people would used to manually review every single document. And now almost all document review, large-scale panel litigations involve some kind of using AI to narrow that down, providing search terms to an AI tool that kind of goes through the documents and provides the hits for that. And, you know, I think most patent litigation practitioners have accepted that. And I think we're going to see that same kind of evolution in other areas of a practice and in patent litigation, patent prosecution. You know, there's all kinds of interesting tools, including, you know, tools to, even during trial, tools to kind of immediately pull up parts of the record that are relevant to what the witness is being asked by opposing counsel and so forth. So I think we're going to see that. I think Sean Lillimo said, I think there will be always room for attorneys who are doing their jobs, for patent attorneys who are using AI. And I agree with that sentiment. I think at the end of the day, you know, the reason people hire patent attorneys, you know, there are inventors who write their own patent applications, and they're probably just as good as the average patent application drafted by a patent attorney. But the reason most hire patent attorneys is because they want their expertise in doing those patent application drafting and prosecution in the best way possible. And, you know, that's what really, you know, sophisticated clients do and sophisticated has counsel. And that's what outside counsel that they try to find. And I think there will still be a need for that, because even figuring out what are the best AI tools to use, how to use them, and so forth, while you're preparing patent applications, while you're prosecuting patent applications, there will be still a big role for that, for patent attorneys to think about those issues and make those decisions and figuring out how to leverage all that to deliver the best possible patents for their client. You know, one thing that I did ask the audience while I was moderating that panel at the USPTO was, in 10 years, who thinks AI will be able to draft claims just as well as the average patent attorney? And the reason that I asked the question that way, obviously, is because I think there's claims out there, issued patents and so forth, where, you know, you sometimes look at that and you think, well, what was that practitioner thinking? And so that's why I said the average patent attorney, because I think there will always be the best patent attorneys out there will be those who take whatever the AI suggests or provides and be able to improve it. So, and it was interesting. I was kind of surprised with that, some of the skepticism that I've heard before that a third of the room raised their hand. So a third of the room at the USPTO at that event thought that it would, within 10 years, AI would be able to draft claims as well as the average patent attorney. So I'll leave that AI discussion there. I'm sure we'll come back to it this season or next season of Clause 8. Two other, I guess, panels that I moderated that stand out to me. One was at the IP Watchdog Live Conference, which is the annual meeting of the IP Watchdog, which I think is the best IP meeting that I've ever been in. And it really, a lot of the focus and a lot of the people who attend, who come there, focus on some of the policy issues related to IP. And I was fortunate enough to be given the opportunity to moderate a panel with some of the voices who would say, present the views of, I guess, probably fair to say, the big tech. You know, one of them being David Jones, a former guest of Clause 8, who's the head of HTIA, the executive director, which represents some of the biggest tech companies in the world on patent issues in D.C. Joe Mattal, of course, who helped draft the AIA legislation, and John Lee, who works for Congressman Daryl Issa on patent issues on Capitol Hill right now. And it was interesting moderating that panel, because my main takeaway from moderating that panel was big tech is actually pretty happy with the way things are right now in terms of the PTAB, Section 101. They might have gripes about here and there around on the edges about there's still too many cases in the Western District of Texas. You know, we wish that have 100% institution rate and so forth, you know, about standards issues and stuff like that. But overall, they're pretty happy. So they love the status quo. And if anybody knows anything about D.C., as David Jones mentioned himself on the podcast, it's much easier to stop things from changing in D.C. than it is to change things. So that's their vantage point, and they're happy where things are. They're not looking to make any compromises or anything like that at this point. One topic that we did discuss is obviously the Patent Eligibility Restoration Act. And, you know, they thought it was ridiculously pro-patent, would ridiculously open up gates to all kinds of patents that shouldn't be patent eligible. And that's Patent Eligibility Restoration Act, which fixes Section 101, which has been the new version of the Section 101 bill introduced by Senator Stillis and Senator Coons. So that's very important. That's her big tech viewpoint. And, you know, it actually happened where John Lee, who's from Senator Issa's office, made the announcement that, you know, there might be a companion to that bill in the House. But he said, you know, he mentioned the way he thinks eventually a fix to Section 101 will happen is that the other side will need to get something. And, you know, based on what I said, the other side, and he means the less patent-friendly side, the big tech side, you know, they're not looking to change anything. So I don't think they're looking to make a deal on Section 101 right now, unfortunately. And that's his view, and we'll see how it helps. The other conference where I was fortunate to moderate panel was the U.S. Inventors Conference. I've interviewed two inventors who play a big role in that organization. One is Josh Malone, the inventor of a bunch of balloons, who survived a big patent battle, and Molly Metz. And I think she's really gotten more involved with U.S. Inventors after I talked with her. But her and Molly Metz and Dirk Thompson, her husband, who is actually now works for U.S. Inventors. So they represent a very pro patent view. They represent the vantage point of inventors who now think that they're wrong to trust the American patent system, to kind of risk everything based on their belief that the patent or patent that they obtained will stop somebody else from infringing it, from stealing their exact idea. They've realized that it's extremely hard to now enforce a patent. They see that the patent system seems to be stacked against them, primarily because of the PTAB. They view it as a death panel where patents go to die. And but also things of like Section 101, enormous cost of litigation and so forth, some of the decisions from Federal Circuit. So that's really their vantage point. But the surprising part about it is, so you could say they're almost on the opposite views of big tech on these, almost all of these issues. But the surprising view is that their view of Patent Eligibility Restoration Act is very similar to those who work on patent policy for big tech companies. They view the Patent Eligibility Restoration Act that has been introduced, the draft version of that, is going to turn into the same kind of Section 101 mess that right now the Section 101 is today, and that the bill isn't really going to help anybody outside of maybe the biopharma space. And I think that's kind of representative of their position, but I apologies if I mischaracterized that. So you know, they at the U.S. Inventors Conference was actually a debate with Judge Michelle, another former guest, and Paul Morinville, who's the founder of U.S. Inventors, and two panel litigation attorneys on the subject. And it's interesting, you know, Judge Michelle, he's I'm going to betray my biases, but I trust Judge Michelle on this topic, but he thinks the Section 101 bill is good and will address the mess that is today, will improve what's patent eligible and what's not patent eligible. Once it's passed, it will be a signal to the courts that they shouldn't be relying on the jurisprudence that they relied on before regards to Section 101 because the Congress is undoing it. So anyway, so as I mentioned on this panel, Judge Michelle was there, and it was also these two patent litigation attorneys. And two patent litigation attorneys who've obviously been in the thick of litigating Section 101 issues and have seen how it's Section 101 has been indiscriminately applied to find patents, all kinds of patents, ineligible, to easily invalidate patents before there's even a trial in district court, and some of these Federal Circuit decisions that went along with that as well. And you could see that their vantage point is what they've been dealing with Section 101, and looking at the Section 101 language, they're looking at the Patent Eligibility Restoration Act, they're looking at the same vantage, and they said they're kind of under saying, well, you know, the same kind of ridiculous arguments that are now being made regarding why patents should be patent eligible under Section 101 will also be made if Patent Eligibility Restoration Act becomes law. And, you know, I wasn't too surprised by that reaction. Earlier in the year, I was in a meeting of mostly patent prosecution attorneys, and they almost had the same exact reaction to most of them to Patent Eligibility Restoration Act. That once again, if you're a patent prosecution attorney, what you've been seeing is all these kind of ridiculous court decisions, the ridiculous logic and analysis that's been used, the lack of complete unpredictability to find patents ineligible under Section 101. And they've also been dealing with the patent office, right? So they've been seeing that, you know, the PTAB is eager for any kind of rationale about why something is not patent eligible under Section 101. It's almost impossible to get a Section 101 rejection verse at the for an ex parte appeal at the PTAB. And also examiners, right? This is what patent prosecution attorneys mostly deal with. And if you're a patent attorney who deals a lot with in areas where there's a lot of Section 101 rejections, it's kind of, you've been through it. And, you know, I kind of coined the term as a patent eligibility stress disorder, right? And I think it makes it kind of accept that, you know, there might be actual, a much better solution being presented, and kind of to view it from that point instead of viewing it from the point, well, how's this new solution going to be twisted to be just as bad as the old solution? And, you know, I think that is the goal. That is why this Patent Eligibility Restoration Act is being introduced, to fix Section 101 mess. And if it does get passed, the only reasonable interpretation will be is that it's being passed because it's being passed to undo the huge mess that the courts have created with Section 101 and to undo that. And I think that'll be the reasonable interpretation. Will there be a judge somewhere out there who might apply the old Section 101 jurisprudence to this, if this new bill becomes law? Well, yeah, maybe. But I don't think, you know, I have faith in the Federal Circuit and the majority of judges of the Federal Circuit that they're going to follow the law if Patent Eligibility Restoration Act becomes the law. I look at the law, I deal with Section 101. I've helped all kinds of clients avoid Section 101 issues, using a lot of strategies for that, and to overcome Section 101 issues at the USPTO, and been successful with that. But, you know, when you're talking about introducing a new law, you know, I do listen to people like Judge Michelle, Director Kappas, Director Iancu, about what they think. Because, you know, sometimes I think it's helpful to have a broader vantage point about what happens, how do judges actually would apply a law like that, and what is their view. But, you know, what really brought me around is actually meeting a very impressive entrepreneur. Hopefully I'll have him close it one day, I guess. But he built an incredible invention, built an amazing company around that invention. And a bunch of big companies ended up stealing his innovations. And obviously he hasn't had the best experience when it comes to the patent system, trying to enforce his patents. But, you know, I was talking to him about this, and first of all, it was amazing to hear some of these inventors' story. Everything they've done, they really truly represent the best of America's US inventors. So I really appreciated the opportunity to do that. But, you know, the one thing that I'm most struck by is how some of these inventors know so much about patent law. They know more probably than some of them know more than most patent attorneys. So I'm always interested to hear their perspective. And I was talking to that inventor, and he actually has a very clever way that he mapped Section 101, the language of the para legislation, and he kind of divided the various portions of the legislation into things that help the biopharma industry versus those that would help inventors related to in the software field. And his view is that everything, you know, all the patent eligibility issues on the biopharma side get resolved by the Patent Eligibility Restoration Act. But the two main clauses, he says, were put in to seem like they're dealing with Section 101 issues related to software-related innovations. They would swallow everything and find everything ineligible. I've looked at this legislation before, but when he mapped it out again, I guess it really made me kind of focus on these two clauses and focus on some of these arguments that I've been hearing over again. And even though his theory was that, you know, biopharma is getting everything and the software inventors who want to rely on the patent system aren't getting anything, it actually made me come to a completely different conclusion. So what are these two clauses? I mean, some of you are probably kind of familiar with them, but one of these clauses says that the following inventions shall not be patent eligible, and one is pure mental process, a pure mathematical formula, an unmodified natural material, modified human gene. I think he's on board with all that. But the one clause that I think troubles some who look at this legislation is the one that says it would not be eligible for patent protection is a process that is substantially economic, financial, business, social, cultural, or artistic. And the point that they make is that these categories, which I think the reason that this legislation has been drafted, this version, is to preempt bad faith arguments about bad outcomes, that if, you know, you got a patent related to a marriage contract or something like that, you know, people won't be able to get married, or, you know, some kind of bad faith arguments like that. And, you know, that's why those categories are listed, and they're meant to preempt them. And the argument that they make is, well, anything could fall under one of these categories. So for example, if you have some new social media platform technology, you know, that would be social under categories. If, let's say, you created the next great artificial intelligence innovation, it would have a huge impact on the economy or financial. That would make it a substantial economic and financial. The latter argument kind of stretches that, right? I don't think it would be reasonable to interpret things like that. The invention itself, even though it might cause substantial economic, financial, or business or social impact, the process would not be substantially fall under one of those categories. But I see there are some edge cases, or maybe even non-edge cases, like the one about the social media platform, where it would fall under one of those categories. And if that clause was there alone, I think the opponents on the pro-patent side against a Patent Eligibility Restoration Act would have a point, because they would then say is that there's these buckets, and these buckets are going to exclude a bunch of innovation that's important and shouldn't be. So I kind of am sympathetic to the concern. But there's an exception to that under the Patent Eligibility Restoration Act that actually says that that would not apply, those categories would not apply, would not make something patent eligible, even falls under one of these categories, if it's the invention is directed to a process that cannot be practically performed without the use of machine, including a computer, or manufacturer. And any process that cannot be practically performed without the use of manufacturer or machine or manufacturer shall be eligible for patent coverage. And the concern, and the concern that I heard, for example, from that meeting of the patent prosecution attorneys as well, kind of the same kind of arguments that you hear now from examiners, that, well, anything could be done by a person, right? Theoretically, right? What is artificial intelligence at the end of the day? It's just something that a person does. Maybe it would take a person a million years to do what the process that of a claimed invention. But the courts or the inventors, if this Patent Eligibility Restoration Act becomes law, it would open these types of inventions to those kind of arguments, and they would be found patent eligible, as these type of arguments have been working now. I don't think it's a reasonable argument for some of the for reason I said. So the language says this cannot be practically performed without the use of a computer. So it's not to say it cannot be theoretically performed, but cannot be practically performed. It would not be practical to implement artificial intelligence without the use of a machine or a computer. It just wouldn't be. So if your improvement, if your invention relies on artificial intelligence, or is an innovation related to artificial intelligence, then of course under the Patent Eligibility Restoration Act would cover it. And I think, you know, once you see that vantage point where it's really limited to those categories that I mentioned, and once again, that it's there's that exception. If something that cannot be performed without the use of a machine or manufacturer, I think harkens back to the mess that was made before the Alice test, to the Alice decision, then the patent eligibility is good. So after I talked to that inventor, I actually came to a conclusion, and you know, I think this is a draft version. There are openness changes. I think this is actually pretty perfect. I mean, if this got passed, somehow the senators, Tillis and Coons, figured out how to get the fellow senators aboard, how to get a companion bill in the House passed and signed into law. Wow! You know, the Section 101 mess would be fixed. It would undo the complete mess that the jurisprudence is today, and it would be a huge win for those who believe that we should have some predictability, a stable patent system where inventors, innovators, and investors know that what is patent eligible and not patent eligible under U.S. law. I think if you believe that, if you believe that patents are good, if you believe that stability and predictability are good, I think you should support this Patent Eligibility Restoration Act. I even hope that some on the big tech side who I mentioned who think that patent system is fine the way it is today for whatever the short-term goals are, also come around to this view. I think if you talk to anybody off the record from any of these companies, companies will tell you they agree that the Section 101 jurisprudence is a huge mess. It shouldn't be the way it is, but I think it's a useful cudgel for them to easily invalidate patents that are being enforced against them. But I hope that they take a little broader view that a healthy patent system is good for the United States. And what's good for the United States, for the innovation ecosystem, will eventually be good for everyone in America, including the big tech companies, that rely on a lot of innovation to stay on top of the global market. So I hope they come around to this view, and I hope that they can embrace it. And obviously, I hope the same thing is true for organizations like US Inventors and for patent practitioners to, you know, come together and embrace the Patent Eligibility Restoration Act. This would be a good starting point to have everybody on one team and be able to provide the support that is necessary to push this eventually through Congress. And in reality, you know, I probably, if this does get to that point, I wouldn't be surprised if there's additional language that would be inserted that would exclude certain types of innovations from being patent eligible. And that might be the part of the compromise process that is necessary. I don't think that should be the case, but I wouldn't be surprised if that is the case. And I think, you know, for that standpoint, you know, I think it's useful to pay attention to if you could trust those who are leading the efforts and who really are your allies in this fight to improve the patent system. This is something else, I guess, that stood out to me from the U.S. Inventors meeting. The U.S. Inventors meeting, they had a long-term ally who used to be on their side, was Representative Thomas Massie, and he was very interested in patent issues. If you'd go on any pro-patent event in D.C., you probably see Representative Thomas Massie, one of a few bipartisan events where he, you know, where you'd see him in, and he'd be praised and he'd be eager to talk about patents. You know, super nice, super friendly, and knew these issues very well, and was very passionate about why patents are a positive force and improving them. And he had these other bills, I guess, that he would introduce that didn't get anywhere, but they were introduced by him to kind of push the patent system in that direction. You know, this Congress, you know, Representative Thomas Massie is on the GOP side. And in the GP conference, as everybody knows, they have a very narrow margin. And Representative Thomas Massie said, I think himself said he likes that because that will provide him with the leverage to get out of leadership what he wants. One would think, because of his long-term time advocacy for patent issues, maybe he would use some of this newfound leadership to make progress on these patent issues. That didn't happen. As everybody follows it, saw what actually happened. Representative Thomas Massie turned out to be more than eager to make deals with the leadership, but they had nothing to do with patents. In fact, he was willing to undermine the positions, his own positions, in other interests. And one of the most visible one was all these machinations on the House Judiciary Committee to push Representative Ken Buck aside from being chairing the Antitrust Committee. And Representative Thomas Massie eagerly went along with it because he was offered to chair that Antitrust Subcommittee. So even though he cared about patent and IP issues and was passionate about them, when a chance came to be on top of this committee, Antitrust Committee, a more prestigious, a more quote-unquote important committee from the viewpoint of big-time lobbyists and so forth, he was happy to, he was happy to go along, which meant instead of asking to chair the IP subcommittee, instead, you know, Daryl Issa, who has been a longtime proponent of the patent troll narrative, became the head of the IP subcommittee. So that was one where he kind of completely was willing to put that aside. He was willing to do that. Daryl Issa became the chair of that subcommittee, of the IP subcommittee. And as you could see, the conversation, Issa has done an impressive job of kind of, you know, really kind of changing the conversation about patents in DC using that bridge. But you could say, all right, well, it is what it is. You know, he also got, I think it's important not to overlook this. He also got Representative Thomas Massie. He got a perch on the rules, prestigious rules committee, and some new select committees for his weaponization of federal government. And he eagerly accepted those new roles instead of focusing on patent issues, where he actually could have done something, right? He could have finally been in a position to do something. He chose not to do it. I didn't know the extent of... the extent that he stepped away from these issues or how much he cared. But, you know, at the U.S. Inventors, they held an event actually on Capitol Hill at their annual meeting, first day. And Representative Thomas Massie was supposed to be a speaker at this event. My understanding was that he confirmed. And then he just didn't show up. He had to kind of, it was in an office building, so he could have just walked and popped his head in. And this same person who was very eager to be at these panel meetings before didn't bother showing up. And this was really in contrast to what something else that I saw at the U.S. Inventors meeting. On the second day of the meeting, I saw Peter Anthony Pappas, who's Senator Tillis's senior IP advisor, was standing in the back of a room. And he wasn't being given any kind of award or being put on a panel or anything else that these types of conferences do to get somebody to come to their conference. He was just standing there. I think it was a Friday, so I think a day that the Congress had off. But he was standing there, and what he was doing is he was standing there and listening to inventor's story. Particularly when I saw it is that he was listening to Molly Metz's story. And, you know, I think it's a often repeated adage, but I think it's true about a big part of life is showing up. And I think you could see Representative Thomas Massie found his association with the pro-patent community useful until he had better opportunities to come along. And at that point, he literally didn't show up. While Senator Tillis's senior IP advisor made the decision to come on his own and be in the room and to hear those stories, even though he might probably wouldn't disagree with some of those other views that were being shared at the conference, he showed up. He showed up to listen to those views, to get that perspective. And I think organizations like US Inventor and others are trying to figure out where to land on these type of issues, who to ally with themselves on Capitol Hill. That'd be an important thing to keep in mind. Who will be your real allies to really advance, to not just be unhappy, to not just be, you know, highlight the issues with the patent system, but to actually improve the patent system, and who is willing to do that hard work to make that possible, the unglamorous work that involves, and will that be Representative Thomas Massie, or will that be Senator Tillis? I mean, I think it's an easy call. You know, Senator Tillis is somebody who has devoted his career to working on a bipartisan basis and trying to make an impact, a positive impact, to forge coalitions, to forge understandings, bipartisan understandings that are necessary to get legislation, IP legislation, into law. And he's willing to do that. He went through, when I interviewed Brett Watts, his former senior IP advisor, about these issues. They had 45 witnesses about the first time they introduced the Section 101 legislation. He introduced it again this year. They're working to do it. And they're doing it because they realize that the Section 101 is a big issue, because it's a big mess, and it's bad for America, bad for innovation in America specifically, bad for investments in America and so forth. And they want to fix those issues. And they're willing to do the hard work to make that happen. We're not going to be ready to jump on the next shiny object that the leadership throws at them to make a deal, because you know, Senator Tillis really cares about these issues. So I kind of want to leave that with that, just my thought. But I think I hope to explore some of these topics in the rest of the season of Clause 8. Hopefully you enjoyed this discussion. Obviously this is different for me asking other people about their views, but I thought, you know, I was preparing for these panels, preparing to ask questions, and some of these thoughts occurred to me beforehand and while I was there. So I thought it'd be interesting to share that. Thank you for listening. I've been listening to this point. As always, please let me know what you like, what you didn't like. And thank you so much for listening to this episode of Clause 8. Tune in for the next episode.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8, the voice of IP. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating in your favorite podcatcher. We'd also like to thank Harity & Harity LLP for their generous support. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. And don't forget to check out our full archive of past episodes. Clause 8 is a Brouhaha audio production. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.